I'm really excited about the Ajax news.
I bet you are. Yeah, the sports news is it's actually going to be properly exciting this week. Explosive news.
It's Friday, April 5th, and this is the Dutch News Podcast, your weekly chance to catch up with what's been going on here in the Netherlands. I'm Paul Peter, civil engineer and happy non-smoker. With me today is Gordon Derrick, contributing editor at Dutch News and Corona Dashboard Mourner. Yeah, we've been away for our Easter break, but we're back again. I'm a little bit sick. I'm a little bit under the weather, but nothing can stop us making this podcast.
Yeah, but we don't know now if you're one of the if you're part of a new wave of corona infections because they've stopped counting. They've decided that corona's over. So perhaps you're the last person in the Netherlands ever to have coronavirus.
Officially, exactly. Yeah, because can you remind us again what the Corona Dashboard is?
Yeah, well, the government set up the Corona Dashboard early on in the pandemic, and it was a way of trying to monitor how many infections there were, and there were constant rows about whether the figures were accurate, especially the figures for deaths, because they weren't. Basically, they were about they only recorded about 40% of deaths through the it was all the information that came from the regional health board services, and so the figures were kind of incomplete, and then there was constant discussion about whether they're reliable, whether they're useful. Of course, you know, coronavirus conspiracy theorists said it was all being exaggerated and overblown anyway, and that the excess deaths came from the vaccines and not from the infections. So, yeah, it sort of stoked all kinds of debate. But it was the government's way of trying to... And obviously, whenever they brought in new measures or new lockdowns or they were trying to persuade people to get the vaccine, they would always point to the dashboard and the rate of infection, and particularly things like the number of people in intensive care and people in hospital, to show why these measures were necessary.
It really feels like ages ago when we had daily push notifications from the NOS informing us about the new updates on the Corona Dashboard, and to see how many new infections there were or how fewer infections there were. It was a way of showing how the measures were working, and everyone was keeping an eye on that famous graph, because if it went lower than, I can't even remember what the number was, but when it was lower than a certain amount, the lockdown would be lifted or restrictions would be lifted. So it was a website that really dominated parts of our lives for many months, not too long ago, even though, as I said, it feels ages ago.
It feels ages ago, doesn't it? It's funny, it's kind of weird that it's been hanging around still, even though nobody's really consulting anymore. We've all kind of forgotten about it. We think we moved on, and yet, you know, coronavirus is still out there. Obviously, people are still getting sick with it. I was actually taking one last sort of nostalgic look at the coronavirus dashboard this week, purely really for the purpose of I had something to say in this podcast. But I noticed that, I mean, even last December there was a little spike in infections, and hospital admissions went up to about, I think, 150 a day at one point. But the difference was that it only lasted for sort of 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah. Which is just like a regular flu season, whereas what was the crushing thing about obviously the early pandemic waves is they went on for months, and the numbers just piled up in the hospitals because people were constantly being admitted and they were staying in hospital, they're being transferred to intensive care, and that clogged up the whole system and put the healthcare system under a severe strain. And that was why it wasn't just a flu; it was something much more serious. But the vaccines seem to have taken care of that now, thankfully, and it's much more like a seasonal infection.
Speaking of some health-related issues, there was some news for... And if you are a smoker, do you smoke, Gordon? No, you don't smoke,
I've never
right?
smoked. No.
Never smoked, me neither. No. So we are not harmed in any way by this news. But the price for a package of cigarettes went up by another euro on Monday. Mm. And if you are a smoker, then you have to pay 11 euros and 10 cents for every package of cigarettes. And I believe a package of rolling tobacco now costs 24 euros. So
my goodness.
Smoking, it is terrible, not only for your health, but also for your wallet. And there is this Dutch word, accijns, which basically means extra taxes. And they put this on a number of products that, you know, are very lucrative for the government. Smoking is cigarettes is one of them, alcohol is another one, and petrol
as well.
Those are the three that are accessed.
Three kind of main fuels, but also sort of major pollutants and things that damage public health. So I guess you can justify it on that way, that there's a huge cost involved in smoking, and the government doesn't want to ban smoking because, you know, that would just be completely impractical and it would stir up all kinds of sentiment.
So instead they turn it into a milking cow.
rather conveniently, they can just collect huge amounts of taxes on them instead.
Yes. So if you weren't encouraged yet to stop smoking, then this is your moment, I guess. And that brings us to the ophef of this week. And this time it comes again from Kaatsheuvel, a small village in Brabant. It's slowly turning into the main ophef generator of this podcast.
It is kind of ophef central this year, isn't
it? So, it is. Yeah. It is the new Thierry Baudet, even though he will make a return on the podcast later this episode. So stay tuned for that. But this time it comes from Kaatsheuvel, where visitors of theme park the Efteling had something to look at. This park is famous for its Sprookjesbos, or a forest with displays of fairy tales. Have you ever been to the Efteling, Gordon?
I've never been to the Efteling, no. No, my children have been on school trips because, that's the thing you do. But I didn't go to school here, so no, I've never been to the Efteling.
Hmm. In the fairy tale forest, Sleeping Beauty is one of the oldest displays. It was even created by the park's official designer, Anton Pieck, who is a famous artist. And with the fairy,
famous designer of his pictures are reproduced on sort of table mats and that sort of thing.
And he really has a distinct style. And whenever you see one of his drawings, you can immediately recognize it as an Anton Pieck. And the Efteling theme park is really designed around his style.
Yeah, it's kind of the original kitsch, isn't it, really, Anton Pieck?
Do you think it's kitsch?
I mean, so I don't know. Well, maybe that's unkind to him, but it's certainly a style that's been much mimicked.
Yeah,
maybe it's become kitsch since his time.
Sleeping Beauty's castle in the forest had been closed for months for renovation works, and Efteling fans were highly anticipating this week's reopening, but they immediately noticed two big differences. Comparisons between the old and the new Sleeping Beauty clearly showed that her breasts had been enlarged. The before and after photos went viral on social media, but because it was around April 1st, everyone immediately suspected this was an April Fool's joke, but the Efteling insisted that this was not the case. They insisted that her new look was real. A spokeswoman of the amusement park acknowledged to Omroep Brabant that the breasts indeed looked bigger, but that the park had aimed to make the display more in line with Anton Pieck's original design. The internet couldn't stop talking about the Doornroosje, which apparently we are going to need to write with two capital D's from now on.
So she's gone from Doornroosje to Pornroosje.
I hadn't ruined that one before. That's a nice one. And I saw this morning that the Daily Mail also picked up this viral news, and they basically went on Twitter and translated tweets about this topic, even though they identified the Dutch language as German. So was it the Daily Mail? No, I think it was an American news website, by the way.
So, more likely, I guess it's changed from confusing it with Danish. So
it is either Danish or German. It's one of the two. So I'm more sympathetic with Denmark, I think.
yeah, yeah. You could have a Lego Sleeping Beauty. Yeah. It'd be very easy to enhance the breasts on a Lego Sleeping Beauty. Yeah, so you just right. add a few just bricks.
Add a few bricks. Much cheaper than closing your attraction for it for many months. Even though you have, I think you are also sympathetic with the Danish, because they also had a failed naval trial with some missiles earlier this morning. Didn't you see that?
I wasn't aware of this.
They had to close the straits because there was some artillery floating around. I don't know what happened, but it reminded me of what happened to the to the Brits a couple of weeks ago.
So the Brits are in good company then.
Yeah, that's right.
The Danes, in having misfiring nuclear subs. Yeah, so two members of NATO now have defective nuclear deterrents. I'm sure that's nothing to be alarmed about.
Not sure the Danish have something nuclear, but
The Danish don't have any nuclear officially. No,
officially, yeah, and they can always
very hot pasties. Maybe they're trying
They can always just easily build a new nuclear bomb, right? They must have a assembly manual laying around somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be like a 64-page booklet telling you how to build your own Lego nuclear missile.
I don't know how you went from Dawn Roche to a imaginary Danish nuclear arsenal.
From Dawn Roche to massive torpedoes. It's been quite a journey already. Yeah. And we're only 10 minutes in.
Let's move on. This week, the Eerste Kamer made a number of controversial decisions. Dutch politicians have come under suspicion following revelations by the Czech intelligence services. Immigration Minister Van den Burg decided that derde landers can be expelled from the country. Oil company Shell is fighting for its life in a court of appeal. It's another week, so another Ajax drama, and the Dutch continue to throw away a fortune.
We start in Groningen because the northern province erupted in fury this week after the Senate blocked the long-promised closure of the gas fields. Senators from the three parties negotiating to form a new coalition, the fourth party, Piet Omtzigt's NSC, doesn't have any seats in the Senate, all agreed to delay a vote on the legislation to shut down gas production, which had been due to be held on Tuesday. They were joined by the right-wing party Jaar 21 and Pensioners Party 50+.
They still exist?
Yes, in the Senate they do. Oh. Yes. Hmm. Yeah. The law has already been passed by the lower house. In fact, 146 out of 150 MPs voted for it. Kasper van der Berg of the VVD party said they wanted to be sure that gas supplies were secure in a fast-changing geopolitical world where there's still high demand for energy from the Netherlands. More than 1,600 earthquakes have hit Groningen since the 1980s as a result of gas production, which has destabilized the ground. 85,000 buildings have been damaged, but only around 30% of affected houses have been made safe, and many Groningers are still waiting years later for their compensation to come through and their houses to be repaired.
So this news was welcomed very much in the northern province, I imagine.
It sort of went down like a Danish missile, really. And they were particularly incensed that the parties that they voted for last year, like the PVV and the BBB, were the parties that voted to delay this legislation. René Paas, the King's Commissioner for Groningen, said it was a bad day for people's trust in politics. He said people were shocked, flabbergasted, furious, or worse, cynical. Hmm. And bear in mind that we've just had a two-year public inquiry into gas drilling and its impact on the province, which concluded that the government and the oil companies had systematically put profits before people. The Dutch state has earned 360 billion euros from the Slochteren gas field since drilling began in 1963. The supply was provisionally turned off in October last year, although Mines Minister Hans Feilbrief did briefly reopen them during a cold spell at the start of January. But the outgoing cabinet's plan was to shut the taps off for good this autumn.
Yeah, and Hans Feilbrief has really become the hero of Groningen in the past 2.5 years. He's been the mining minister. How did he react to the news?
Yeah, he was absolutely apoplectic. He was very, very emotional. He said he would answer any concerns the senators had as quickly as possible so that the vote can take place within a month. But he also threatened to step down if there was any further delay. He said, I'm not going to be playing games where the Senate just carries on stringing this out. And if that happened, he would quit as minister and take a seat in Parliament.
And this rarely happens, that ministers threaten to resign. I've never seen that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and his voice really cracked when he was talking about it, and he asked what people in Groningen were supposed to make of the move after years of debate, and he spent a lot of time up in Groningen, as you say, trying to sort out the compensation issue. It was really, he had this dossier thrown at him basically after the two previous ministers from the VVD, who were Erik Wiebes and Henk Kamp, had made a real pig's ear of it. Well, Erik Wiebes had started the shutdown and was initially received very well in Groningen, but then his relationship with them soured. But Fjellbrief, anyway, has really kind of gone into bat for Groningen and has become a champion of the province. And he, I think, was aware how sensitive it was, because even back in January, when he just switched on the gas taps for, I think 3 days or something, because it was a bit cold, there was uproar about it and people saying the government are betraying us again. So I think he's very, very aware of just, you know, any, even the slightest suggestion that the government might be going back on its word. The trust is so fragile and brittle at the moment that it's absolutely fatal. And he also suggested that perhaps this might be some kind of a tactical ploy by the four negotiating parties to play for time so that the new cabinet can make the final decision.
Yeah.
And he said if political games are being played over the heads of people in Groningen, that would be a disgrace. And within a day, we started to hear the screeching of tyres as the parties, I think, realised they'd overplayed their hand and hastily started to backtrack on the decision. Kasper van der Berg said it had all been a big misunderstanding and he was sure the Senate would approve the delay. Caroline van der Plas said the BBB supported closing the gas fields 100% and she hadn't doubted for a second. And Peter Omtzigt said he was hugely surprised by the vote and it wouldn't do Groningen's trust in the government any good. But then the BBB and the PVV sort of compounded the distrust by not turning up for a debate in the lower house on gas drilling, which was prompted by this decision. And so that left the floor free for the left-wing parties to attack the VVD, who did turn up, for suggesting that gas security was more important than the stability of people's houses. So the spectre of another VVD minister starting to talk about gas security, I think, was the ultimate trigger for people in Groningen.
And the PVV not showing up for debates really is a recurring theme.
It's becoming something of a habit, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Those weren't the only ructions in the Senate this week.
No, the upper house is fast becoming the place where legislation goes to die. Last week, senators voted down a law to reduce workplace discrimination, which would have required companies to spell out what steps they're taking to ensure all job applicants were being treated equally. This was a measure by the outgoing cabinet, and it had already been watered down by Social Affairs Minister Karin van Gennep, so that companies with fewer than 50 employees were exempted from the scheme. It had been 25. And also she agreed to introduce a transition period. But the three negotiating parties in the Senate all voted against it, and so too did Jaarin en Twintig and Forum for Democratie and the SKP. Van Gennep said the lost vote was very painful. And the Telegraaf reported this week that the BBB is set to vote down a 1.2% rise in the minimum wage, which would also require state pensions and social security benefits to be raised in line. That would cost 800 million euros. But the negotiating parties, including the VVD and NSA, have said that the new government needs to tighten the purse strings. Which could prompt a clash, I guess, with Geert Wilders' PVV, because he's all for raising social security spending, and he says he will not accept any major budget cuts. So, yeah, does this tell us anything, cast any light at all on what the state of play is in the talks between the coalition parties, the way they've suddenly started blocking things in the Senate?
Yeah, it is probably a sign that they are making progress, because, you know, these are very impactful pieces of legislation, and if you are on the brink of forming a coalition and forming a new cabinet, then these are the things you want to decide and not leave up to the previous cabinet that is still outgoing. So it might still be that they will decide that the minimum wage will rise, perhaps even higher than being proposed now, even though I doubt it. But it just shows that they want to make the decisions and not the previous cabinet or the previous Tweede Kamer.
No, yeah, and but it is at the same time. It means that an awful lot of planned legislation, planned reforms, are being held up by the fact that the coalition talks are taking so long, and the parties want to be able to decide for themselves. So
I remember Geert Wilders saying to Frans Timmermans in one of the debates, "Normal people cannot wait; they need." a rise in minimum wages, for example, yesterday and not in a couple of weeks. So it is interesting how these things
work. It is curious, but it's how the coalition talks always work. Yeah, that was particularly about the proposal to abolish the onerous payments in healthcare, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right. Yeah.
Which suddenly the PFFA voted against, even though Fleur Ackermann has been campaigning for it, you know, constantly for about a decade.
A Czech news website released a bomb over The Hague this week by reporting that Dutch politicians were among a number of European far-right politicians involved in a Russian disinformation campaign. According to Deník and sources in the Czech intelligence service BIS, politicians had taken money to spread pro-Russian propaganda via the Prague-based news website Voice of Europe and speak against the European Union, for example. The website was originally founded in the Netherlands between 2017 and 2019. It was initially closely linked to Forum for Democracy, it still is, by the way, before being relaunched in Prague last year after a number of Russian oligarchs had acquired the Voice of Europe. BIS didn't identify the politicians by name, but a number of Dutch far-right politicians, such as Forum for Democracy leader Thierry Baudet and MEP Marcel de Graaf, have often appeared in interviews with the Voice of Europe, and they have made no secret of their support for Russia, but both have denied any of the allegations.
Yes, although when they had a debate on the Russian revelations, where Hugo de Jonge appeared very prominently, our favourite politician, survivor of the coronavirus dashboard, one party was conspicuous, very conspicuous by its absence. And who were they, Paul?
That was Forum for Democracy.
Forum for Democracy, yes.
Yeah,
the party that was at the foundation of Voice of Europe, and of course itself emerged from a campaign to vote against the accession treaty of Ukraine to the European Union.
Something that worked very much in favor of Russia and Putin.
Whose leader has said since the invasion of Ukraine that Putin should be seen as the leader of conservative Europe and has been very mild in his treatment of Ukraine. So I don't know why people suspect Thierry Baudet of being the person who's the Russian mole in Dutch politics. It's a complete mystery.
It is a complete mystery to me too. But there was another big name from Dutch politics who has appeared very regularly on the Voice of Europe, and that's none other than PVV leader Geert Wilders. He is currently, as we already mentioned, in the process of forming the new government. And Wilders has always been very critical of the European Union, so in that regard he was always very welcome on the Voice of Europe, but he also famously visited the Russian Duma in 2017, so initially he was regarded as Russia-friendly, even though a couple of years ago a plane carrying almost 200 Dutchmen was shot down by Russian-backed Ukrainian nationalists.
Yes.
Separatists, I have to say.
Yes, but a little while later, 3 years later, the penny dropped that with Geert Wilders that perhaps visiting the Duma was not a very wise move, given that Russia had killed 200 Dutch citizens on board MH17.
But in 2018, Wilders praised the Voice of Europe for its unique and valuable work, and he claimed that he got all his news from the website, so he's a very big fan of the Voice of Europe, a website that is now linked to pro-Kremlin propaganda. Wilders was, however, the first person to demand clarification from Home Affairs Minister Hugo de Jonge after the Czech publication. She was clearly trying to break with this image and with his ties to the Voice of Europe. He also denied any financial involvement with the website, even though Wilders has had close ties with other pro-Russian politicians from Europe, someone like French politician Marine Le Pen. Her campaign to become the French president was partly funded by a loan from Russia. He has always been friendly with Alternative for Deutschland, which has also been linked to Russia. And of course, Philip de Winter, the Belgian politician who invited Russian spies to parliament and also has all sorts of dubious links to totalitarian regimes.
Yeah, but I think the feeling was that Wilders, by doing this, assuming it wasn't an elaborate double bluff, he was quite clearly looking to distance himself and wash his hands of any association with Russia. And you probably think that Geert Wilders is experienced enough and shrewd enough to have actually cut his any ties or certainly remove any trace of a connection with Russia since the invasion of Ukraine. I think he is sensible enough to realize that that would be absolutely fatal. If any connection in the last 2 years were to come out, so I think the feeling is that Wilders is probably not the guy who is if there is a double agent in the Dutch Parliament, it's not Geert Wilders. Which again, but of course, we did have a debate on Monday, where Hugo de Jonge, the outgoing Home Affairs Minister, was faced a lot of very pointed questions about who the person was and why he wasn't able to disclose any further information.
Yeah, the debate was on Tuesday, but on Monday there was a briefing with MPs in the Tweede Kamer where he already told the MPs explicitly that he wasn't going to reveal any names. He didn't even say that he had them, but if the reports in the Czech media were true, then it was really up to the Czech security services to release this information if they wanted to, and he wasn't going to say anything. Regardless, there was still a debate on Tuesday where he reiterated and repeated everything that he already said, even though, you know, there was no point of having this debate because he was still always going to say this. But a lot of politicians really wanted to make clear, basically used the debate to attack Forum for Democracy, who, as you already mentioned, wasn't present at the debate. There was also an interesting moment when Caroline van der Plas stepped forward and she said, yeah, I admit that we have received some donations to my party by people with Russian names. It was a total of 160 euros, but we immediately wired that back to the sources. So I never imagined that Caroline van der Plas could be bought for 160 euros, but yeah, she wanted to mention this anyway. MPs did argue, though, that while there is no clarity, Dutch politicians will remain under suspicion, and this could also hurt the upcoming European Parliament elections in June. Wilders called on de Jonge to go as far as he can to bring clarity. Caroline van der Plas said that without names and numbers, the uproar could ruin the reputation of Parliament. Hugo de Jonge told MPs directly on Tuesday that concerns about foreign interference are justified. He pointed out that the AIVD, the Dutch Security Service, has been warning about the situation for years, but he said he respected the Czech position not to give additional information at present, and he wouldn't pressure them into doing so.
Yeah, but it was a sort of fascinating debate to watch in one way, of course, because the five biggest leaders of the five biggest parties form a committee that gets briefed by the intelligence services, I believe, on a weekly basis. It's known as the Committee Stiekem, the sneaky or the secrecy committee. So there were five people in the room who obviously knew more than they were letting on, or than they were allowed to let on, because the convention is that anything you're told in that committee stays in the committee room. But of course, one of the five is Geert Wilders, who was also one of the names that was circulating the media as a possible possible Russian connection. But yes, I think the elephant in the room was the absence of Forum for Democracy, but it's really curious. But also, I think when you unpick a bit what Hugo de Jonge said, one thing he said was he couldn't name names because it might prejudice a criminal investigation.
Yeah.
Now, if there was no criminal investigation to prejudice or no prospect of a criminal investigation, then that wouldn't be an issue, surely.
No,
so that sort of implies
that
implies that the prosecution service is looking at this information as well, and that there is a realistic prospect that somebody might, if they can put the evidence together, which obviously is always difficult in espionage cases, there's a prospect that somebody might at some stage be prosecuted. So that does sort of seem to back up what the Czech intelligence service has said, that the Netherlands is one of the six countries where the Russians have been interfering with domestic politics.
Yeah, we should check what Wi-Fi Thierry Boudet is using, because if it comes from a car parked outside of his window, then we definitely know that that's a smoking gun.
Dear de Lunders, it might sound like a terrible song by Bluff, but the reality is even more discordant. Some 2,500 third country nationals who fled Ukraine after the Russian invasion have been left in total limbo about whether they'll be allowed to stay in the Netherlands. The government's official line is no, they can't, and the Deputy Justice Minister Erik van den Burg has given them a deadline of April the 2nd to leave the country or apply for asylum, in which case they'll have to move into refugee accommodation while their claims are being processed. And van den Burg said this week there was no change in that guidance, even though several courts have ruled in cases brought by third country nationals that they should have the same rights as Ukrainian nationals. The problem is that the Council of State has really muddied the waters, because it had previously upheld the asylum minister's right to remove the protected status of these third country nationals. Some other lower courts have said that decision should take precedence. And on Tuesday, the Council of State made things even more complicated when it was considering appeals from six people who had been told to leave the country. And it said it was seeking clarity from the European Court of Justice. And those six appellants should have the right to stay until the decision comes back from Strasbourg. The European Council has previously ruled that temporary protection for Ukrainians should be extended until March 2025, and the third country nationals argue that they should be covered by it too.
And while the court ruling is pending, are the evictions going ahead?
Well, that was Erik van den Burg's guidance. He told councils that there was nothing to stop them evicting non-Ukrainians who, until the start of March, had the right, were covered by the more generous asylum regime for Ukrainians. And on the back of it, several councils have already started eviction proceedings, such as Dordrecht, where 90 people have been told they will have to leave the accommodation facility by the end of next week, and Hilversum. Other municipalities have said that they will allow the Nederlanders to stay, including Groningen, Eindhoven, Arnhem and Ede. The local government association VNG has advised councils to hang fire and not evict people until the legal situation is resolved. And it's widely expected to trigger more legal challenges by other third country nationals, because the Council of State ruling only applies to the six people who brought appeals. So the obvious thing then is for anyone else who wants to stay in the country to then bring a court case. And that's almost certainly going to happen. Phil Eichelbaum, a lawyer who represents several Nederlanders, said in a social media post that van der Burg's actions were incompatible with the rule of law. So some fairly hard language there.
So could you explain to us what Nederlanders exactly are?
Yeah, Nederlanders, apart from people who trigger awful songs in my head every time I hear the phrase, there are about 2,500 people from other countries who arrived in the Netherlands from Ukraine since the start of the invasion. Many of them were students, or there were people who'd married Ukrainians or had gone to live there temporarily. And the key thing was they all had temporary residency rights. They didn't have a permanent residency. If you have permanent residency, you are covered by the Ukrainian rules. So the Dutch government initially included them in the group of Ukrainian refugees. They didn't have to. The European Union's guidance only applied to Ukrainians and people with permanent residency, but it meant they had the right to work and claim the same benefits as Ukrainians. But last year, Erik van den Burg decided he wanted to withdraw these rights because he felt that it was making the Netherlands too attractive a place for people from third countries. Originally, he wanted to start sending them home in September. The Council of State said no, he couldn't do that. He'd already granted them the same rights up until March this year, so they had to stay until then. But in another ruling in January, the Council of State said it was okay for him to start to give them 30 days notice to leave the country or apply for asylum. And now many of them are students or people from countries like Morocco or India, which are classed as safe countries by the Dutch government. So they don't have much chance of being granted asylum, and they will almost certainly be told to return to their countries of origin. But they argue that they were building up new lives in Ukraine, so they want to go back there when the war's over, and that they should be allowed to stay in the Netherlands in the meantime. Van der Burg says the asylum system is overburdened and is meant for people who are unable to return to their countries of origin because it's not safe for them to go there. He says we can't accommodate people who have a safe place to go elsewhere in the world. It's that moment again when we say a big thank you to all the people who are kind enough to put a few of their hard-earned dollars or euros towards keeping this podcast on the rails. We'll never take away our patrons' privileges or threatened to have you deported, you will get a shout out on the podcast, extra votes in the OPEF of the Year awards, and access to all our bonus content exclusively via the Patreon page. There are four tiers of membership, depending on how much you're able or willing to contribute. And your donations really do help us to help you make sense of everything that's going on here in the Netherlands, although I have to say this week it is exceptionally confusing.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And to make things even more confusing, the next bonus episode we are going to record is on the verzuiling, or the pillarization, a term that you hear very often if you follow Dutch media a little bit. And we are going to unravel all the mysteries about these voluntary segregation, as some people have called it, that have dominated Dutch life well after the Second World War. We wanted to record that earlier this week, but unfortunately I was sick, so we had to postpone that. But it is coming up probably next week, so stay tuned for that. And log on to Patreon and become a Patreon donor if you want to hear that episode.
Yeah. Now, this week we have one new patron to thank, so thank you very much to Cipian Grindianu. If you'd like to become a podcast patron, log on to www.patreon.com, that's patreon.com/DutchNewsNL.
Shell has launched its appeal against a 2021 landmark ruling. The former Dutch oil giant is making an effort to overturn a court order to cut carbon dioxide emissions more quickly than it had planned. The case was brought by environmental campaign group Milieudefensie and helped pave the way for a string of other cases in which industry and government have faced legal action for endangering the public. If the ruling remains intact, Shell will have to cut its carbon dioxide emissions by 45% by the end of 2030, compared to 2019.
Yeah. So what exactly is Milieudefensie accusing Shell of doing?
Milieudefensie argues that Shell is also responsible for the emissions caused by users of its products. The company has long known that carbon dioxide is the main cause of climate change, but its plans to reduce emissions are inadequate and vague. Milieudefensie also says that Shell, as a company, has higher revenues than many countries' GDPs and should therefore be regarded as a global player. Also, the global emissions by Shell is higher than some countries. So Milieudefensie basically says you are an international player, so not a private company. Mm-hmm. The court in The Hague agreed and ruled in favor of Milieudefensie in 2021, saying that it is part of Shell's duty of care to limit its emissions more quickly, including those caused by customers using their products.
Right. But I guess those people have their products because Shell make them available on the market, right?
That's so, right, yeah. So yeah. Shell also has to do an effort to reduce their basically the secondhand,
to sort of just discourage people from using secondhand pollution, discourage people from polluting with their products. Where does a certain cellar hatch fit into all this?
Duty of care. Law school students' hearts will jump whenever you mention the Kelderluik arrest, the cellar hatch ruling. In 1965, the Supreme Court ruled that the person who opens the cellar hatch is responsible for the danger it poses to passers-by. In the famous court case, an employee of Coca-Cola, so another big name, a big company, big multinational, was loading drinks into a bar cellar in Maastricht when someone fell down the hatch. The court ruled that the employee should have realized he had caused a safety hazard and should therefore have barricaded the hatch to prevent people from falling. And yeah, this ruling has really said that companies, and by extension also Shell, have a duty of care. So they, if they are potentially harming people by their actions, they need to take the necessary precautions in order to prevent that from happening. And following this line of reasoning, Shell too has a responsibility to take measures to reduce its carbon emissions and therefore limit the dangers to the public caused by climate change.
I love the fact that this whole case is about somebody falling down the hatch while loading drinks, because of course down the hatch is something you say when you you drink up.
If the ruling is upheld, then Shell might go down the hatch as well.
It might. Yes, indeed. So Shell obviously disagrees with this legal argument. So what's its case?
Yeah, they say it is endorsing the need to take action against climate change, but they believe it is up to the legislature and the government to determine what needs to be done. And this should not be determined by the court. Shell says it is already complying with all environmental and climate legislation. But Milieudefensie says, yeah, this is not enough. And as a global player, you cannot be expected to only held to the Dutch legislation. You need to do more. If you are active in other parts of the world, then yeah, you need to reduce your carbon dioxide emissions there as well. And Milieudefensie is confident that the appeals court will uphold the 2021 ruling. They have submitted 650 pieces of additional evidence, updates on climate science, and have called in new expert statements. So they are very very confident the ruling will be upheld.
Upheld, yeah. So the court is basically saying the Shell has to be more proactive. It can't just fall back on the old argument of saying, well, it's technically legal, therefore we should be allowed to do it.
Let's see. Yeah.
Yeah. On to sports news, and the woes for Ajax just seem to be never ending. I don't know if you've seen that episode of The Simpsons where...
What? Is it? Tell me more.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that episode of The Simpsons where Sideshow Bob is walking around a field full of rakes and steps on every single one. But that field appears to have been transplanted to the Johan Cruyff Arena, because literally every day or every week that goes by, Ajax seem to manage to fall down another pitfall or step on another rake.
Yeah.
This latest enormous scandal that's erupted concerns the new CEO, Alex Kroes, who finally started work 3 weeks ago. He'd had to wait 7 months after he was appointed.
Was it because he was a British national waiting for his Brexit application?
No, it wasn't to do with him getting his Brexit clearance. No, he had to have clearance from his former employer, AZ Alkmaar, because Ajax actually poached him from AZ, and he had a non-competition clause in his old contract, so they actually had to sort of thrash out how long he had to sit on the sidelines before he was allowed to step into the COO's office at Ajax. But if
Ajax had attracted him a couple of months ago, Ajax was so low in the ranking that clearly the non-competition clause wouldn't have applied to Ajax. So
yeah, exactly.
He
was almost he almost made the case of saying that they weren't really direct competitors.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, he had 7 months. He had some time to kill. He had to keep himself busy, and he seems to have kept himself busy sort of tracking Ajax's stock price because it emerged this week that. The week before his appointment was announced in August, he purchased 17,500 shares in Ajax, which topped up his personal shareholding, almost doubled it up to about 42,000. Kroes said
For how much money per share did he buy this? These 17,500 shares. Do you know that?
I don't know that. No.
€11.50. Do you know how much they are worth now?
They're probably worth about the same. I would
10,
think.
20. So he made a loss.
He's made a loss. Yeah, he's lost like €1.20 and his job.
So it's, yeah, exactly.
Kroes argued in a post on LinkedIn this week that this was his way of showing confidence in his employer, that he was prepared to stake some of his own money, a whole €11, in the club's possible potential future success. But unfortunately, Ajax's supervisory board didn't quite see it that way. They looked at it and they took legal advice and they said this smells very much like insider trading, which of course is a criminal offence, because Kroes was the only person at that point who knew he was going to be appointed as the new CEO, which you could have guessed would have encouraged, had a positive effect on the share price, because it looked on the face of it like it was Ajax getting his act together. But in hindsight, of course, that wasn't happening. The chairman, Michiel van Praag, issued a strongly worded public statement. He said Kroes's actions were highly detrimental to the club and everyone who holds it dear. And he said that the club could not condone what was basically quite possibly criminal behaviour. Yeah. So the club says it will now put forward a motion to dismiss Kroes as soon as it can organise an extraordinary general meeting. But given Ajax's organisational skills so far this season, that may yet prove to be his saving grace.
What did Kroes have to say about this anymore?
Well, he said he doesn't accept the board's decision and he intends to seek a ruling from the financial regulator IFM. He insists he didn't buy the shares to make quick money. Well, and that certainly is borne out by events. Ajax hasn't exactly been a solid investment in the last couple of years. The club has sacked two managers and its director of football, Sven Mislintat, who is implicated in a conflict of interest scandal over his over the player transfers. Mislintat was a replacement for Mark Overmars, who of course left the club in disgrace 2 years ago as a result of Dick Pick Gate, which seems to have been the first of many dominoes that perished in the
only
saga.
Thing is the only thing missing here is a sparrow.
Indeed. Kroos was appointed to take over from Edwin van der Sar, who suffered a genuine misfortune. He stepped down as CEO last May, but then shortly afterwards he suffered a brain hemorrhage while he was on holiday. Thankfully, he's given an interview last month where he said he was making a good recovery and there were no serious lasting effects. So that's one piece of good news around Ajax. On the pitch, though, Ajax finished third last season, which means they missed out on the lucrative Champions League, and they are currently fifth in the table with 6 matches to play.
After this, you can only think that Ajax is the king of misfortune of the Eredivisie, but that's not entirely the case, is it?
No, there is one club that actually manages to eclipse them on that, and that's Vitesse Arnhem. Is this week the newly appointed interim managing director, that's the second one they've had this year, Edwin Reintjes, openly admitted that the club had not met the conditions of the KNVB's licensing committee. Obviously all football clubs have to have a professional license, and he wasn't even sure if Vitesse could see the season out. They've been struggling ever since their Russian owner, Valeri Oif. There's a lot of Russian involvement in this week's podcast, isn't there? Valeri Oif put his shares up for sale after the invasion of Ukraine. The club's running a deficit of around 3.5 million euros, and it's failed to file its accounts on time for the last 2 years, and it's been fined for that. It also got fined for ceasing its relationship with Rabobank. There was an American investor on the horizon, Coley Parry, who came forward with a rescue package last year, but the buyout was blocked by the KNVB because they said it lacked transparency. So Parry then instead agreed to bankroll the club in the form of loans, but they came at a very heavy price with high interest rates, and they're basically now in even deeper in the shit than they were before he came along. Yeah. Well, among other things, Parry is threatening to claim back the money that Stoke City paid for the wonderfully named Million Manhoof. or Million Euro Manhoof, the winger who left Vitesse in January transfer window. He wants to claim that transfer money as collateral. And if Vitesse can't square things with the licensing committee and make up their shortfall, then they face a points deduction, which would mean certain relegation and quite possibly the death knell for the club. Yeah. Not that the points deduction is going to make much difference anyway, because last weekend they lost 2-0 to Sparta, which means they are 5 points behind the relegation line with 6 matches left to play.
Is there anything else happening on the pitch?
Well, PSV Eindhoven lost their unbeaten record in the Eredivisie at the weekend. They lost to NEC Nijmegen, who won 3-1. That ended Peter Bosz's dream of going through the season unbeaten. It was a story of two penalties. The veteran former Ajax midfielder Lasse Schöner, who's going to be 38 next month, equalised for NEC from their penalty spot just before half-time. And then the Nijmegen club scored twice more in the second half. And to really add insult to injury, Luuk de Jong had his penalty saved by Jesper Cillessen. Jesper Cillessen, who is one famously of the notoriously bad penalty savers. So bad, in fact, that when he was playing for the Netherlands in the 2014 World Cup, Louis van Gaal actually substituted him before the penalty shootout.
Yeah, I don't know much about football, but I know one thing, and that is that Jasper Cillessen is very bad at holding penalties. And I think after that World Cup, he went to Barcelona, FC Barcelona, which also surprised me, because, you know, what is, as a keeper, you need to do a couple of things, and that is stopping penalties, right? So why would one of the top clubs in the world hire someone that, you know, on paper never stopped a penalty? Because I think that was the case back then. So that's a bit of a mystery to me.
Yeah, generally speaking, keeping the ball out of the net is a quality that is sought in goalkeepers. Yes. to his credit, did manage to do it on this occasion. Luuk de Jong, who's one of the best penalty takers in the Eredivisie. But PSV look like they're going to march onto the title. They're still 7 points ahead of Feyenoord with 6 matches to play. So unless they suffer a kind of Bay or Danish military style collapse, they should wrap up the league title. But Lasse Schöner scored a penalty, so at least one Dane has been on target this week.
That's right. The targets for recycling plastic bottles and drinking cans were again not reached last year, but fewer were found in litter, according to Verpakt, the industry body charged with dealing with recyclable waste. It's been 1 year since 15 cent deposits or statiegeld were introduced on aluminum. No, I can't remember what the.
No.
Aluminium drinking
aluminium,
cans.
Yeah.
Yeah. And 65% are being handed into collection points. The return rate for plastic bottles is a bit higher, with 71%, but the official target is 90%, so that means that a total of €374 million are not collected by consumers. The can collection scheme was introduced in April last year and has been beset by problems, including a shortage of collection points, malfunctioning machinery in supermarkets, and a surge in scavenging for cans in litter bins.
Yeah, also a surge in school children going around tables at like ice cream parlors and things and asking if they can take your empties away for you.
Oh, yeah, okay, that is a nice aspect, I think. small children making a bit of an effort, getting some more change.
You can't start too early with the FEOC mentality.
No, exactly, yeah. Verpakt is working on introducing more collection points in a wide variety of locations, such as gyms, cafes, schools, and in public transport. And where do you think they get the money for introducing all these new collection points?
Where they get money for introducing collection points, I have no idea.
It is the money they save by people not collecting.
Oh, well, people not collecting
their statiegeld.
Not claiming back their statiegeld.
No,
yeah.
So they're going to invest this 374 right. million euros into more collection points. I thought that was a nice detail. Mm. And also collection points in public transport. I wonder how that works, but.
I wonder if they can do this for football clubs, you know, and unused footballs or something. You should have a statiegeld scheme, and then maybe Fitzerandum can somehow stay alive by if people in Arnhem can collect enough cans or fish enough footballs out of canals and claim the statiegeld, then they might be able to rescue their local club.
Fill the Gelder Dome with collection machines and let everyone deposit their aluminium cans and donate the money to the club. Last September, government officials gave Verpakt an official warning for failing to reach the 90% target, but the industry body stressed the return rate is growing and pointed out that countries such as, I mean, we can't have a segment without this country, Denmark, and Norway, they needed 8 to 11 years to reach the 90% mark. And Verpakt says we are well on schedule. I mean, after all, it is money that, you know, whenever Dutch people can make money, they will do their best to get it, even though it is a very tiny amount. It's just a matter of time until we have reached the official...
So we hit the 90% limit. Yeah, good.
That's all that we have for you this week. This podcast is a production of Dutch News, which can be found online at dutchnews.nl. We will include links to everything we've talked about today in the liner notes. You can get in touch with us by email to podcast@dutchnews.nl. And if you want to help us out, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating. You can also back us on Patreon at patreon.com/dutchnewsnl and earn yourself a free shout out on the podcast. My thanks to Gordon Derek, and we'll be back next week.
Okay. Or we can get people. Or people can just collect donate us their statiegeld.
Yeah, exactly.
From their tin cans. Yeah. That's another option.
Just make sure you deposit your cans first and then send the money. We don't necessarily want the cans.
We don't need a whole pile of tin cans. No. In the podcast studio. No.
According to Denk? No, it wasn't
Denik.
Denk.
It's Denik, isn't it? Denik, not Denk. No, it wasn't.
It wasn't Stefan
von Baar. is that Czech infiltration?
The long arm from
the long arm of Czechia has reached the Schilderswijk. Yeah.